the door just in case someone's talking.
Yeah, be nice. Yeah. All right.
All right. I'll be right back.
The House Committee on Revenue for March 11, 2015 will come to order. As you can see, it is now 1 o'clock. We'll open the information meeting on the high cost of low wages from the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. And Paul, are you introducing that? Paul is introducing that. All right.
So, Mr. Chair, I believe we should have some information appearing on the list.
About to show up, huh?
Yes. Okay. So, we have coordinated with other committees to have the Labor Education Research Center come and present information on the high cost of low wages, and they are here to go through that with the committee to present. And we have the material we've gotten, and my understanding is this has been shared with some other committees as well.
Okay.
So this is an informational background, and I'll let them come up and go through their material.
Great.
This is an issue we've talked about kind of in general, but now we've got some folks that have done some research in this area.
Welcome, and thank you for coming today. We appreciate it.
Should we just get started?
Okay. Yes, please. And state your name for the record, if you would.
My name is Rahi Reddy. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, Vice Chair Vega Peterson, and members of the House Committee on Revenue. My name is Rahi Reddy, and I'm a faculty member at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. Our center delivers education programming, conducts applied research on vital social issues related to work and employment. We're really excited and grateful for the opportunity to be here with you today to share the findings of our latest research, The High Cost of Low Wages in Oregon. We began this research project in earnest in 2014. Like many of you, we too wanted to understand how this economy is developing, and in particular, wanted to understand the rise of the low-wage sector. The Office of the State Economist published a sobering report in 2013 studying 30 years of job growth in the state and confirmed what we believe to be true, that middle-wage jobs are disappearing and the jobs replacing them are low-wage jobs that cannot support a family the way middle-wage employment had done in decades past. In the state's job analysis, low-wage jobs were defined as those that earn less than $25,000 a year for a full-time worker. This translates into an hourly rate of about $12 an hour or less. In our estimates, over 400,000 Oregonians earn these low wages. For the sake of consistency, our report uses the state's definition of low wage, though we believe it yields conservative estimates of the number of Oregonians earning low wages. As you will hear today, many low-wage workers are unable to find regular full-time work, making it difficult to even make these annual earnings, even at $12 an hour. And as the cost of basic necessities continually rise, yearly earnings of $25,000 still does not afford families the economic security they need to make ends meet and avert financial disaster. The national discussion we've been having about the rise of income inequality and its impact on our nation was also compelling to us as we conceptualized our study. There's growing consensus among economists and policymakers, everyday Americans, and even our nation's millionaires that income inequality is limiting our nation's economic progress. But again, we come back to the Oregon picture. What does low-wage work and the growing prevalence of it in our state mean for everyday Oregonians? Our study examines what low-wage work is in Oregon, including what industries have the greatest reliance on low-wage workers. We also go deeper and ask the question of what the true costs of the growing low-wage sector are to workers who are employed in these jobs, their families, and to the state that provides programs that help these workers remain housed and avoid hunger. Are there costs to all Oregonians when workers earn wages that fall below what is needed to afford the basic needs like housing, food, childcare, and having a small savings cushion to avoid financial disaster? Our colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, the University of Wisconsin, and the University of Illinois had produced state studies exploring the costs to states for providing public assistance to working adults when their wages were so low that they qualified for these programs. We wanted to understand that picture as well in Oregon. Our report is unique compared to these other state studies, something we're very proud about. We developed our analysis first from available state and national data on low-wage employment in Oregon. And we complete the picture with findings from a series of interviews we conducted with low-wage working Oregonians. These interviews give us a window into the daily struggles of everyday Oregonians trying to survive on low wages and unstable employment. We've been able to weave together a more comprehensive picture of low-wage work lived on the ground as well as seen in economic trends. We know that our report is the beginning of a conversation. There is much more to explore. But we know that there is also an imperative. It's imperative we get a full understanding of the problems of low-wage work. The urgency of tackling this issue is now. Low-wage occupations are some of the fastest-growing jobs in the state, making the need to understand these issues even more urgent. We also know that if we don't understand the many true costs of low-wage work to workers, their families, and to the state, then it's difficult to develop the kind of robust solutions we need to help Oregonians move forward. We really look forward to having this dialogue with you today. Thank you. I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Ellen Scott, to talk a little bit more about the interviews that we conducted with low-wage working Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Pedersen, Vice Chair Benz, thank you, and members of the committee. For your time today. We really appreciate it. My name is Ellen Scott. I'm on the faculty at the University of Oregon in the Department of Sociology, a longtime career of studying low-wage workers and their care work obligations as well. Today I'm going to share findings from interviews that I conducted with 44 low-income parents in Western Oregon. In their own words, they told me about the challenges that they face to get by on their low wages. And I'll highlight a number of the challenges, such as erratic schedules, lack of sick leave, trouble arranging child care, frequent job changes, and periods of unemployment, all of which result in difficulties making ends meet on low wages. The parents we interviewed were typical of low-wage workers in Oregon, and briefly, over half of minimum wage workers are women. Contrary to popular belief that low-wage workers are teens, the average age of a minimum wage worker is 35 years old. Race still matters in employment. In Oregon, people of color represent 20% of all low-wage workers. And an urban-rural divide persists. People residing outside of metropolitan areas are much more likely to be employed in low-wage jobs. In fact, exactly half of the workforce in eastern Oregon works for under $10 an hour. The parents we interviewed worked in some of the most common low-wage occupations in Oregon. They worked in retail, fast food and food services, manufacturing, and personal and health care services. They typically had fewer hours than they wanted. Their jobs were often temporary or seasonal, and they had unpredictable schedules and non-standard hours. And based on their reports of their hours and wages, we estimated that their average monthly income was $1,300 gross, a shockingly low wage, especially given that these were single parents with an average of three children. $1,300 is not nearly enough to cover housing, food, childcare for three kids, let alone transportation, medical expenses, and other necessities. It's no wonder that so many low-wage workers rely on public assistance. And all the parents that we spoke with received childcare subsidies. Most received SNAP or food stamp benefits, and some received a housing subsidy. Quite simply, they could not manage without these state benefits. In their case, critical work supports that allow them to sustain their families despite earning such low wages. Low-wage workers, including the majority of those we interviewed, contend with erratic employment schedules and non-standard shifts. This makes it very hard to organize daily life, especially life with children. Having flexible caregivers is a requirement in managing the life of erratic schedules, and for many, finding such caregivers is quite impossible. And as a result, many of our respondents were unable to take or stay in jobs with these demands. Some were allowed to have input in their new schedules, but most didn't have this privilege. And for example, Terry, a single mother of two, and I use pseudonyms in this, who worked at a large box store, told us they'd say you're going to have a set schedule, and you'd work that schedule for 2 months, and everybody's happy, the kids are well-adjusted, and then we're going to change your schedule. Terry was able to manage this constantly changing schedule in large part because her mother, who was able to be flexible, took care of her children and was paid through employment-related daycare. However, finding a replacement for her mother after her mother died suddenly was very difficult, given this flexibility that she required. Some parents had regular shifts, but in order to accrue enough hours, they also worked on call, which meant, again, irregular days and shifts. Jill, a Native American single mother with some college education, had worked as a janitor for a large nonprofit doing 3 graveyard shifts and an on-call shift, one swing shift each week. And then she did varying days and doubles to fill in when employees were absent. She said, I work with one agency, but in that one agency, I've got a regular job and 3 on-call jobs, and another agency's on-call. This life of erratic scheduling was possible for Jill again because she either took her child to her mother who was paid through ERDC, or she left her son at home asleep when there was a roommate at home. The low-wage workers we interviewed typically didn't have workplace benefits. Paid sick leave was something that most could not count on, and their stories are riddled with the difficulties of caring for children or for themselves without that leave. And in fact, some lost jobs as a result of not having paid sick leave. Tabitha, a mother of 2, worked in manufacturing doing 12-hour nighttime shifts. Her job was not family-friendly. Each minute she arrived late or missed a day due to illness counted toward a tally of work time missed. She had a son who had asthma, so she did frequently have to miss work, and she ultimately lost this job due to her absences. When we interviewed her, she had been unemployed for a year. She was not receiving TANF. She also lost her child care subsidy, and so that made it very difficult for her to look for work. Low wages, erratic schedules, and lack of sick leave create a situation where it's hard to get ahead or even to stay employed. Job instability, that is, moving from job to job or periods of unemployment, is a critical problem that low-wage workers face. The majority of our respondents experienced both job changes and or spells of unemployment during the 2-year period that we reviewed. And for a variety of reasons, this was the case. Their jobs were temporary. They sought better jobs to make ends meet. They were let go after periods of missed work due to illness or family crisis, or the job ended in a recessionary period, industry decline, or finally, employers didn't provide a reason for the firing. And Tori, an African-American single mother of 1, had cycled through a number of jobs that she found through the TANF jobs program. All of the jobs were temporary. None transitioned into permanent positions as she had hoped. Eventually, she found work at Subway, but the job was completely inflexible. She was allowed no time off for illness, including any kind of scheduled thing. She had a scheduled surgery. She called her boss. She arranged to have the time off, but she was fired. And she said, they let me go because I had surgery. And after a short period of relying on unemployment, she found another job, but she had only had that job for 3 weeks. Her mother became ill and was hospitalized. Her mother was taking care of her daughter, the granddaughter, and so Tori had to be out of work in order to care for her daughter, and she was fired again. Suzanne did seasonal work for a fruit and vegetable company. She worked 5 months out of the year, had done so for 5 years. She hung in there with this job despite unemployment from December through May because she anticipated that she would eventually rise to the top of these coveted jobs where there would be a permanent full-time position available to her. I don't know what transpired in her case. Because their wages were so low, their hours often part-time, and their workplace benefits lacking, the parents we interviewed were forced to rely on a variety of public benefits. Perhaps the most common were child care subsidies. However, even with subsidies, parents who worked erratic schedules or non-standard hours were sometimes forced to choose providers who were unreliable or who did not provide quality care. Finding stable child care is imperative for working parents and, of course, particularly for single parents. Arranging reliable, trustworthy, high-quality care is particularly challenging if you have low earnings, erratic schedules, and non-standard hours. All the parents we interviewed received child care subsidies, and they consistently told us that without that subsidy, it would be impossible for them to work at all. Simply put, their earnings were too low to pay for care. So, for example, Martha, a white mother of 2 who worked as a server in a restaurant, reported, there's no way if you didn't have state care babysitting, I could afford $600 or $700 a month, $800 a month in child care costs with two kids. I make barely $900 a month right now with $324 of my son's child support. And Mary, also a white single mother working as a, in a rehabilitation facility as a CNA, said, I could work, but I'd be living out of a box or my car, because how do you pay for rent and pay your daycare? So I'm glad that we do have a subsidy, so then I can work and do what I'm supposed to do. The parents we interviewed struggle to make ends meet in low-wage work. They juggle multiple jobs, they do extra shifts, they accommodate just-in-time scheduling, they do graveyard shifts, they change their schedules, and despite all of this, they somehow manage childcare and family life. But the wages they earn and the hours they work are simply inadequate to support their families. Some tried to escape their low-wage jobs by getting additional education, but they told us stories of incurring substantial debt and not gaining access to better jobs. And I can tell you one of those stories later if you'd like. They told us they felt they were doing everything they were supposed to do, but they could not overcome the obstacles. And indeed, they were often one step away from catastrophes such as homelessness or debilitating illness or disability. And again, happy to share some stories of those situations. But I hope that their stories help you as you consider the difference that some of the bills will make, could make this year, higher wages, for Oregon's poorest workers, the importance of subsidizing child care for low-wage working parents, since the market cost of care is truly unreachable for them, the importance of paid sick leave, or at least unpaid sick leave, in which you do not lose risk losing your job if you stay home to take care of yourself or your child, and finally, the difference that stable schedules and advance notice of variable schedules could make for families trying to manage in these jobs. Thank you for your time today. I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. I also hold a faculty appointment at Portland State University in the School of Community Health. Our Oregon represents a number of organizations and individuals who care about many issues, from preserving funding for schools and critical services to protecting the environment. I personally conduct research on a number of different topics, ranging from public assistance, government finances, education, and public health, and so on. So I'm here today to tell you about this study. Based on data on about 197,000 working adults in Oregon who received food stamps in January 2014, we estimate that the total cost of providing public assistance to working families in Oregon exceeds $1.7 billion per year. And I'd like to tell you just a little bit more about how we got to that number, and then I'm going to try to put that finding in the context of sort of what's been happening with Oregon's economy. So for this study, we received data from the state summarizing the industries in which people who are receiving SNAP were working. And although we didn't get any specific business names, the industry categories are very specific. So we can distinguish fast food restaurants from other kinds of restaurants, for example. And we know that of this group of people, this 197,000 workers, they averaged $12.36 per hour in 2013. So that's a low wage. It's consistent with what else we know about the low-wage workforce in the state. In 2013, over 1 million Oregonians were served by the SNAP program, which is really a pretty staggering number. And many of these people, most of them, also receive services through other programs. So 78% of SNAP recipients are also receiving medical assistance. And so using statistics on the concurrent use of programs, we can take those SNAP data and extrapolate them out over other assistance programs as well, and that's what we use to get our estimates. And so this $1.7 billion estimate is based on three major programs: SNAP, medical assistance, and employment-related daycare. So of this $1.7 billion, it wasn't surprising to us to find that over 60% of those workers worked in sort of just four sort of major industry sectors. The number one sector is the accommodation and food services. These are mostly restaurant workers, about 13,000 fast food workers, about 12,000 workers in other kinds of restaurants. Hotels and motels also employ about 5,000 workers receiving assistance. Retail trade is a close second. This covers supermarkets, grocery stores, big box stores, and gas stations. Again, not a big surprise. There's a recent national study estimates that Walmart alone, when you look across the country, that Walmart workers receive over $6 billion in subsidies for those workers and their families. In third place is the healthcare and social assistance sector. Most of these folks are providing services to people who are elderly or disabled, whether in their home or at a assisted living residential facility, retirement or nursing care. There are many thousands more who also work in sort of hospitals and ambulatory care, and child care is also encountered in this sector. And then finally, rounding out the list is the administrative and support services sector. This covers temp agencies, call centers, janitorial and landscaping services. So these are businesses that provide support to other businesses. So with that information in mind, I'd just like to switch gears a little bit and talk about some trends in Oregon's economy. From a big picture, our economy actually looks like it's doing really well. Our gross state product has been growing about three times as fast as the gross domestic product. And this is sort of a good measure of the overall size of the economy. But sort of hidden within that growth is that most families in Oregon are not sharing in those gains. And actually, most families have actually seen their real incomes decline over the years. This graph, these are data from the Oregon Department of Revenue. And they compare, based on the percentile of income, the average income in 2002 versus 2012. And what you could, these are adjusted for inflation. And so what you can see is basically the bottom three quarters of the income distribution has seen their incomes decline over this period. And income gains have largely been limited to just folks at the top end. And of course, the top 1% has seen the biggest gains over this time. When you look closer at the tax data, you find that those taxpayers with the highest incomes, they get most of their money in the form of capital gains, dividends, and taxable interest. Right. So this is income that comes from already owning lots of financial assets. So as the economy has grown, the gross state product has grown. The share of that gross state product that has gone to corporate profits has also increased. So corporations are grabbing more and a greater and greater share of those profits, and then along with the increased kind of correspondingly, the share that goes to workers' wages and salaries and benefits has been declining, and this is sort of consistent with what we've seen about the declining wages and incomes for most Oregon families. Corporate profits today are at record highs. And this graph goes all the way back to 1947. And so we have a situation where the economy is growing, but all those profits are really going to boost corporate profits, which then go largely back to the top 1% who own most of the corporate stocks and bonds. And so this is sort of the dynamic that's been happening. I just want to highlight two key trends about how corporations have been able to boost their profits. The first is through outsourcing. Major U.S. corporations have outsourced literally millions of jobs from the United States over the past few decades. And for the most part, these are not jobs that have just been made obsolete by technology. These are just jobs that were moved to other countries where workers get paid less. And the manufacturing sector across the country has been the hardest hit by this outsourcing. And with millions of these good sort of middle-income jobs gone, now there's just a much greater competition for the jobs that are left. And that's really just enabled these big companies to pay people less and continue to chip away at sort of wages and benefits over time, and also to use more part-time workers instead of hiring full-time workers. And clearly, that's something that we've learned about in our interviews as well. Kind of the prevalence of part-time work. Of course, another way that corporations boost their profits, and one that's maybe particularly relevant to this committee, is that they have gotten really good at dodging taxes. So Bloomberg News reports that major U.S. companies have now stashed over $2 trillion in profits in foreign subsidiaries. That's 2 million millions of dollars, which is just a really staggering number. By hiding this money in foreign countries, these companies manage to reduce their tax bills, both at the state and the federal levels, by billions of dollars every year. And so I'll just leave with that. So they've gotten very good at hiding their money from taxation. In addition to that, two independent reports have found that Oregon has the country's lowest effective business taxes. And so that means that even though taxpayers are effectively subsidizing the workforce of large profitable corporations, the assistance we're able to offer and the investments we're able to make in things like education and roads and services and so forth are actually limited because we just don't actually collect that much in taxes from businesses relative to the size of our economy and the amount of profits that companies are making. So with that, I would just say thank you again for your interest in this research, and I'd be happy to answer any questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Very provocative presentation today. So, questions? Stunned silence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, maybe it's my turn then. I want to make certain that I understand one of the charts that you have, and I'm looking at, I think it's page 8, where you show the percentage of gross state product. That one, yes. I have to admit right up front that I am a bit under the weather today, but I'm having trouble understanding how these two items add up to the 100% of the Oregon gross state product. Can you help me with that?
Oh, yes. Representative Chair Barnhart. No, that's a good question. So they don't actually add up to 100%. There's other stuff that's in there. Let me backtrack. These data come from the Bureau of Economic Analysis from their gross domestic product accounts. So these are data that are updated, I believe, every year for every state. And they provide very detailed information by state, by industry, and by all these different breakdowns. But this stuff gets tallied up to equal for the assessment of the gross state or domestic product. So there are essentially three kind of major categories that they look at. One is the employee wages and benefits. One is basically profits to business owners. And then the third is what's called gross operating surplus, which is the return to capital, which is a proxy for corporate profits. So the sliver that goes to business profits is pretty constant over time, and it's just not included in this graph just for simplicity. So it's really the share going to employee wages benefits and going to corporate profits, that those are the two things that have been changing. So that's what's displayed on this graph.
Okay, yes,
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here and for this research. I've taken a look at this online previously. I was really intrigued by it when it was released. I think in the Oregonian had a story about it a while back. This is really stunning information, in my opinion. And the thing that particularly captures my attention is the idea that we as taxpayers are spending a whole bunch of taxpayer dollars to help subsidize essentially the operations of some big companies so that they don't have to pay their workers as much. And the question that I have for you is, to the extent, you had a picture of Ronald McDonald in there, you had a photo of Walmart or a reference to Walmart, and it sounds like there are some big national corporations that seem to be extremely profitable, that you read about, as being extremely profitable, who are particularly called out in this. Other states must be having this experience too, right? And we have, it sounds like, lower corporate taxes than in a lot of states. But how are states across the country responding to this issue, as we try to figure out what reasonable next steps would be?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leninger, thank you for the question. In part of when we were working with our colleagues at UC Berkeley Labor Center, Center for Labor Research and Education, they actually were conducting statewide studies of every state. And one of the things they have talked a lot about is states taking on raising the minimum wage. So a number of states, I think it's about 16 states that are enacting policies to raise the wage for workers. Paid sick leave was another area of policy work around the country to to stabilize work. And I think, you know, for us, what we looked at is really there's two key issues here. One is raising wages and just having, you know, wages are just so extremely low, especially for the, in these firms. And then the other piece is stabilizing work. So the number of hours folks are working, the stability of hours, just-in-time scheduling. And so in other states, there are policy and legislative efforts to create more stable schedules for workers and have some accountability on those issues, have paid sick leave, secure retirement or creating opportunities for retirement security in other states. So again, it's like a whole host of efforts that in each of these states that they're taking on. And it was just a piece of what we looked at in our report.
May I ask a follow-up?
Please.
I have a vague recollection that in somewhere in California, did a city pass some kind of law that targeted specifically national companies that were paying poverty-level wages in that city? Because, you know, candidly, and I support increasing the minimum wage and have been public about that, but candidly, there are market differences in Oregon, you know, and $15 an hour is a lot different for, you know, the owner of a small restaurant in the Phoenix Talent area in Southern Oregon than it might be for someone in Lake Oswego. But have there been some more tailored efforts to get at things like, I know that there's been talk of potentially a fee to be charged certain businesses that don't pay, that we are essentially subsidizing through, you know, food support and housing support through tax dollars. What kinds of efforts like that have happened?
So there are early efforts in some states to look at a fee that would target companies that particularly benefit from their employees being on public assistance. They're very much in the early stages. Mm-hmm. From what we know, I think there's two places in the country that are looking at that.
Okay.
Yeah. No?
No, thank you.
Representative Benz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. I have actually two questions. The first one, Walmart is mentioned frequently in these conversations. And, of course, the reason people go to Walmart is because the prices are extraordinarily low. And somewhere I heard that there's a 80% of that which is sold in Walmart comes from China, which would reflect the outsourcing suggestion, if it's true. I don't know if it is or not. But that which they sell is kept inexpensive by virtue of that which they pay. There's an assertion that the taxes imposed upon a corporation are immediately passed on to the consumer. So I just went online here to check who shops at Walmart, and I'm guessing that the folks that are in the lower income brackets all shop at Walmart. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what the benefit is of imposing upon Walmart the obligation to pay more, let's say, $15 an hour, which is immediately passed on to those who are shopping there, which are the very people who just got paid $15 an hour. So now I'm asking this as a setup for the next question, but go ahead and answer it, then go to the next question.
Thank you, Representative Benz. This is actually it's a really interesting point, and I've actually been reading recently how Walmart sales are down because their customer base doesn't have enough money to spend at their store. So, you know, when we're talking about you know, raising the wages for low wage workers, you know, it's really about putting a lot more money in the pockets of people who spend essentially all the money they have, and that money goes to then circulate through our local economy and also to benefit the those large stores that people shop at. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think that, you know, both small and large businesses are hurt when their customers don't have the resources to spend.
And can I just jump in? I wanted to just speak to the price issue. in San Francisco, there's been a number of studies of the impact of raising wages on local economies and businesses. And in retail in particular, the studies have shown that labor costs are actually a fairly low percentage of retail costs. And what they found in San Francisco when they not only raised the wage but also implemented paid sick days is that it was just a nominal impact, A, on the cost of doing business, and B, that those costs were not passed on to consumers in that county. And again, we are really excited to engage in this conversation with you and be happy to pull together any resources you would need to look at those studies. And, you know, there's just a lot of interesting and exciting scholarship happening right now assessing the impacts of these kinds of policies. So we'd be happy to share with you.
And just add one more point, which is that one of these studies shows that it costs about 25% of an annual salary or the wages paid to a worker in every time you retrain somebody. So the lack of the diminished turnover in employees is also a tremendous profit source for the companies when they raise wages.
Follow up. Yeah, I think it's clear that most people don't want to have to work at Walmart their entire life. In fact, I believe Walmart is pretty much a training site for many folks that move on through that entry-level position and on up to better jobs elsewhere. I don't want to say that people don't want to make a career of working at Walmart. Perhaps they do. But I'm guessing many view it as an entry-level position. And, of course, that's why they're paid so little. That would be my take on it. But my purpose in getting to the point here of whether is really I don't quite see the benefit in taking money from these larger corporations and handing it back to the workers. I'm not sure that is what the real problem is. I think the real problem is found in where the products they are selling come from. And what I would suggest is that the foundation for the difficulty that we're facing is two things, and you mentioned them both. You mentioned one, and that is outsourcing or globalization. And the other is mechanization. And what ends up happening, and I want your thinking on this, is that when one forces a wage increase upon an employer, they're going to trend toward mechanization, which is what's happening in rural areas. As the wages are pushed up, then what we see happening is bigger machines are purchased in the same circumstance in almost every situation. And if you look at the book, I think it's called The Second Machine Age, you'll see that the author believes that we have lost some 30% of our jobs to these two issues. He also suggests some solutions, but I'm not thinking that forcing a minimum wage is one of them, but I'm anxious to hear your thoughts.
Sure. Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Benz, you know, it's a really interesting point. Thank you for bringing it up. I guess it makes me think about the growing disconnect between productivity and wages. So even though there have been really astounding technological advances over the years, which have made workers more productive, their wages have not increased in proportion to that productivity. And so even though the returns on capital are greater, the workers who are still running those machines, working in those industries, are not sharing in that economic growth, and as a result, that money is really leaving largely leaving the communities and not staying to then circulate and grow and help the economy thrive.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I think you raise some really interesting points. Even our world in academia has changed a lot with with mechanization, and actually has helped us a lot too. Makes Googling articles much easier. But I think one of the things that I want to just bring us back to in this report is the jobs that we're talking about in the low-wage sector. 75% of those jobs are found in the five industries that we discussed that are all place-based industries. So these are food service, healthcare, accommodation, folks that are teaching your children, people that are caring for your seniors. So these are place-based, home in Oregon jobs. And I think one of the things we wanted, and we're really excited to be able to have this conversation, is you know, how do we address these issues for folks that are living here and working here and where the jobs are really growing here? And I think those are some of the key questions that we are trying to address in this report.
Yes, please. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to go back to the comment about productivity not necessarily benefiting the worker. Of course, what happens is the worker is replaced. Mm-hmm. The machine takes their place. We may have seen the issue addressed in an article in Bloomberg 2 days ago or three, where they were showing the increased use of robots in China, and that 30,000 jobs a month or something being disappeared by the installation of robots. And so I would suggest that whatever the solution might be, it has to address the primary cause of the problem. And the productivity piece is extremely interesting and worthy of more discussion, but the figuring out of how to fill in the empty space created by the two issues I just discussed is really the issue. And waving a wand over it and saying it's going to get better by raising the minimum wage ain't going to do the trick. It has all the burdens that we just heard mentioned, and there's better ways to do it. But that's not the focus. What we should be looking at is where are the really good jobs that we want people to aspire to? And the answer is they're not here. We've been replaced. What do we do? And whether it's to go to the place-based discussion about care jobs, which is actually it's two authors of the book, as Representative Reed reminded me, and they suggest personal care issues, which have to be managed by people, which, given the advancing age of some of us on this dais, perhaps that is the proper focus. But that's where I think these conversations should lead us.
Actually, the age of the committee has gotten younger.
So
over the last couple of years.
It's advancing, though, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it's still, that's inevitable, isn't it? Representative Smith-Werner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you're welcome for anything I might have done in lowering the overall age of the So I would like to think. A couple things. I wanted to comment on a couple of things that Representative Bentz mentioned and then also ask a question of the panel. On the one hand, I would say Representative Bentz said he wasn't sure about just moving money from Walmart to the workers is necessarily a plus. I think it's a huge thing, and I think that is, you know, economically, that's one of the biggest things about bringing up low wages and the minimum wage is, as one of you mentioned, there is such an immediate economic impact in that those are folks who are spending almost all of what they are bringing in. And so I think there is a pretty significant value in anything that can be done to transfer more of that money from Walmart to those workers. But I must say, Representative Bentz, I certainly hope when you were looking up information about Walmart that you weren't looking at the site called The People of Walmart or something like that, because it might have you might have found it troubling if you've never looked at it. And perhaps if you have, I apologize for putting that idea into your head. But more importantly, in addition, another thing that comes up a lot, as and it's kind of wrapped into this, is, again, with increasing of minimum wage in particular, is this premise that, well, all that does is it brings you're going to impact these low-wage people by driving them off some benefit cliff and reducing the amount of those public benefits that they're getting. I would posit that I think that from a policy perspective, that's shifting the responsibility for people's economic well-being to perhaps more of their employers and less of the state, and I think onto where it belongs, as a lot of this data demonstrates how much subsidizing we are doing of these employers, allowing them to pay these low wages and continuing for folks to get to that. But I wanted to get your more academic perspective on that thought, on what about the idea of you raise the wage and you just end up harming them because you're reducing their public benefits.
Yeah. And before they answer the question, I just wanted to remind members of the committee that the same rule applies here as applies on the floor. In reference to other members. Thank you. Go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you.
We shouldn't say their names.
Please.
Representative Barnhart, thank you. Representative Smith-Werner, thank you. This is an important question. I'm sure this will be part of your conversations over the next weeks and months. Exactly as you stated, it is the ideal that people move from public benefits to being able to be supported by their own wages, by the wages that they earn. And in fact, they state over and over that they prefer that. They don't like relying on public benefits. They internalize the shame attached to that, believe me. And they talk about wanting to do what they're supposed to do. In point of fact, though, the benefits cliff is a lot lower than we think it is. And that is a policy issue. We can set the benefits cut off where we want. Where it is now in practice, a family of three, it's about at the federal poverty level, which is about $9.52 for a family of three an hour if they're working full time. That's a low wage, $9.52 an hour. So any bump in these wages will quickly bring them above that so-called benefits cliff. But the other point that I think is really important to remember is that this is something that's negotiable. I mean, yes, if we implement an incremental shift in increasing wages, or if there are people who are caught in some kind of benefits cliff, that is something that we can address as policymakers, as members of human services departments, et cetera. We can negotiate where that line is and who continues to need the benefit of food stamps or a housing subsidy or a child care subsidy. But again, remember that a significant increase in the minimum wage will bring people well above what is currently that benefit cliff.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you. So thank you so much for your presentation. It's been very informative, but also it confirms with data, I think, what a lot of us have been seeing in our communities, in our districts, in terms of the effect that not just this recession, but the fact that how the economy has changed in the last decade has affected our neighbors and our communities. So I appreciate that. And as I listen to the testimony that you give, it really strikes me that there are two kind of core issues as I see them. One is the impact of poverty on the lives of people because of the low wages that they have, or the fact that the wages that they're being paid are only at a part-time rate versus a full-time job where they would be getting more hours and therefore more money. The other is the fact that workplace policies don't match up with what the families look like, with modern day families look like, whether it's because there's a single family home or because there's a mother working and not staying home. And so that there's really two things that we're dealing with when we hear what you have to say. And I just wanted to know if you could, speak to that in terms of the policies, that would have had impact on people's lives, it seems to me in some of the stories you were talking about, like childcare was such a key issue. Mm-hmm. And if that was a factor, somebody had said, and I forget who it was that quoted to me, was, really, we're relying on grandma. Grandma is the reason why we are having, we have so many people who are able to go out and get jobs because we have grandma, who is like the unacknowledged and then a lot of times unpaid person who's allowing this to happen.
Right. Thank you, Representative Peterson and Representative Barnhart. This is, just a critical issue. And this could get as big as we want it. So I'm a single parent. I'm employed at the University of Oregon. Child care saves my life all the time. And if I didn't have the resources to pay for it, I'd be in deep trouble. And any working parent will tell you, what would this world look like if we had a universal, publicly subsidized child care program like public education? I mean, what if we started public education in infancy? So this is not just an issue, as you say, for very poor families. It's an issue for all of us. Now, the resources, of course, that we have to work with and the current political state, I don't think we're talking about universal child care anytime soon. So yes, I would say to you that one of the most critical things that continues to be before us is what kinds of resources are we willing to put into subsidizing the child care of families whose wages are too low to pay for market care. And the quotes I gave you, I mean, you know the numbers, what it costs for child care. They're spot on. They could not, with their wages, pay for child care. So this is a real issue. If we want to invest in our workforce and if we want to invest in people who are doing their best at very, very low wages, I think child care costs and child care subsidies are one of the critical work supports that we have to continue to consider funding at fairly high levels, or families will fall apart. And many of them do rely on family, but they are also able to
to rely on family because they can pay for their care through ERDC. And we have stories of people. We have one story I didn't tell today, a woman who was self-employed. When ERDC changed the eligibility criteria so that self-employed workers were no longer eligible, she lost her child care subsidy. Her child care for her three children absolutely fell apart because her mother could no longer do it, and because she couldn't pay her to do it. So she started farming her kids out to various friends. She had them stay home alone with the eldest, who was 12. The eldest was started to be stalked by somebody she encountered online. This produced an incredible crisis. The woman's business fell apart. She was self-employed cleaning apartments and had built up a strong enough clientele with all of the apartment managers in town. She was doing pretty well. She had really come out of the depths of poverty, and it all crashed. So there's a lot of pieces to ERDC that are critical, and you know, I couldn't say more about how important the program is for our poorest workers in the state.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Just follow up. And this isn't a question. It's more like a comment. But after we had our last revenue forecast, I had a conversation with Josh out in the hall about female participation in the workplace. And one of the things, and it was coincidentally, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal later that day about the female labor force participation. And in countries in Canada and in Europe and in Scandinavian countries, they actually have a higher participation because they have more workplace policies that allow women to participate in the workforce, and therefore they have more economic benefit and more economic juice in the economic engine, I would say, for that. So I just, you know, I think that we are, it's not only, it's better, I think, for families, but it's also, you know, better in terms of our ability to have, you know, economic movement in this country by having some of these policies.
Thank you. Roughly, what's it?
Yes. I was wondering, you had numbers up earlier about what food stamp recipients, SNAP recipients did for their work. And I was wondering if you could tell me how many food stamp recipients are unemployed. And the reason I ask you this is today in a magazine called Governing for the States and Localities, this came out. It says, since the recession, Oregon has also qualified for a waiver that allows able-bodied adults aged 18 to 50 who do not have dependent children to receive SNAP, even if they do not meet the program's work requirements. And I was wondering if you have the numbers, as you were giving those, of how many actually don't work in any capacity.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. So let me think. I think the answer is yes, somewhat. So yes, the SNAP program, these program statistics are available. One of the tricky things is that because there's so much job churn, people go on and off of the program. We really have to look at it's not always easy to look directly at the people who are currently working or currently not, but the but in general, there are about, I think there are about 500, there are about 500,000, I'm sorry, there are about 782,000 SNAP clients in January 2014 overall. 500,000 of them were adults, and we saw data on about 200,000 working people. So you know, from that, I'd say 200,000 out of 500,000 is about 40% of those SNAP recipients who we classified as working people. Working adults, so we'd say that the best 60% would not be working, would have not worked the previous year.
Does that make sense? 60% of the SNAP recipients
of the adult SNAP recipients,
right, that's did not work the year before.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, comments? I'm going to say this has been an extremely enlightening presentation. I appreciate it very much. I know that work is hard, and pulling it together in a way that's presentable to a group of people with mixed academic backgrounds is challenging. I think it was a great presentation and may very well be helpful to us as we and other committees around the building do our work. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anything else on this one? Okay, so we'll close the information meeting, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2940. I'm sorry. Did I get that wrong?
2074.
Let me check and see what where I am here, because I may have. Which do we have more signups for? 2077. Okay. We will close the public hearing I just opened on House Bill 2940. We'll get to that later, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2077. And I was intending to open the one that has the more witnesses. So. Well, we'll reopen it later. Yeah. Thanks. Chris.
Boy, that third one has started.
Whoa.
We'll get that one for you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2077 is a corporate disclosure bill. It would require corporation, excise, and income tax filers to also file a disclosure statement with the Secretary of State. The bill specifies that the policy applies to all publicly held traded corporations, all financial corporations and insurers, as well as any other corporations with an FTE of at least 25 employees or at least $10 million in Oregon sales. The bill requires that the first statement be filed for the state fiscal year 2015 by March 15, 2016, and then at the same time as the corporation's tax return thereafter. The bill identifies all of the information that would be required to be included in the form. It's largely tax return information, and it allows the Secretary of State to impose a penalty for corporations who fail to file that report.
Bravo. Thank you very much. Any members here who want to be heard? It's a big room, and I'm not seeing any. I'd like to call first Daniel Morris, Dave Rosenfeld, and Chuck Shepikoff, please. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, again, I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2077, which will give lawmakers access to information they need to craft smart tax policies. As a researcher who's passionate about good government, I spend a lot of time studying statistics from the Department of Revenue, in addition to state tax laws. And I think this information is really important because it can inform good policy, and it can help us understand just which businesses or taxpayers are affected by potential tax changes. Since Oregon has the lowest business taxes in the country, I think it's natural to want to focus on business taxes to find ways to raise revenues, whether that's by increasing tax rates, eliminating tax breaks, or otherwise tightening up the tax code. I think there's a general sense out there that big corporations are not paying their fair share of taxes. And along with that, I think there's strong public support for raising taxes on corporations. But of course, it's not just about raising revenue. I think we all want policies that are right for Oregon's economy, and that we can feel more confident in those policies when we know that they're based on good data. While publicly traded companies are required to disclose information on sales, profits, and taxes, and executive compensation, these data are only provided at the national level, and they're not broken out by state. So, unfortunately, right now, the information that's available is actually pretty limited, because companies aren't required to disclose this state-level statistics. The aggregate statistics do give us a good sense of the big picture, but they just aren't available in enough detail to tell us the effects of particular tax changes on certain businesses for the most part. So I just wanted to briefly give the committee a few examples of some of the things that I've run across in the course of my research that I'd like to know more about, that House Bill 2077 would enable more information to shed some light on this. So first, in tax year 2012, which is the most recent year that statistics are available, there were 393 corporations that paid $0 in income taxes because they were able to use tax credits against their minimum tax. These tax credits can be expensive, I know we all want to make sure we're getting our money's worth out of them. But if we don't have good data on which companies are earning, selling, or using tax credits, it's a lot harder to make that determination about whether those credits are achieving their intended outcomes. So a tax disclosure law would enable us to know more about that. Again, that same year, 20 corporations that each reported more than $10 million in taxable income were still eligible to pay Oregon's minimum tax.
And though these 20 companies collectively reported $783 million in income taxable in Oregon, collectively they only paid $100,000 in taxes. So I can't tell you whether they each paid $5,000 or if one paid $100,000 and 19 paid zero. But it's certainly something that I was curious to learn more about, and it seems like it would be informative for tax policy discussions. And then finally, as I mentioned a minute ago, Bloomberg News reports that companies, major U.S. corporations, have stashed over $2 trillion in offshore subsidiaries. Though the profits held in certain tax havens are now counted towards Oregon's taxes, we really don't know what other countries these companies are using as tax havens. And having access to that information would help inform discussions in front of this committee around adding additional countries to the tax haven list. So again, I can only imagine how many times members of this committee have sort of run into these challenges with not having enough information about corporate taxes. And I know that since the policies that that come out of this committee can have such a profound impact on Oregon's economy, I believe that greater transparency into these issues can make us all feel more confident about the effects of our revenue policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Rosenfeld, Osperg's executive director. Thank you for considering this matter. Osperg supports several provisions in House Bill 2077, the details of which are in our written testimony. I won't itemize them here. The reason why we support those provisions is we think those could be an important tool for you all in addressing the issue of tax avoidance through offshore tax havens, which is a big problem. It's estimated that about 70% of the Fortune 500 companies use offshore tax havens to reduce their tax liability by stashing profits offshore. About 8,000 subsidiaries, what we've counted thus far since 2013. Oregon, we estimate, loses about $200 million annually in revenue in state revenue as a result of this practice. And when some set of corporations use offshore tax havens to avoid paying their state taxes, the rest of us pick up the tab in terms of higher taxes for the rest of us, cuts in public services. And small businesses are one set of people that are impacted by this. We estimate that if you took all the lost revenue, corporate revenue, as a result of this kind of tax dodging and then reapportioned it and forced all the small businesses in the state to have to then pay to pick up the tab, that'd be somewhere between $600 and $700 in additional taxes every year that each small business in the state would have to pay. Beyond that, there's an anti-competitive thing. When some set of businesses are able to, just by virtue of the fact that they have the resources to have tax attorneys and tax lawyers and that kind of thing, cook up schemes to be able to reduce their liability, then it creates an unlevel playing field. And so as a result, you have two different kinds of tax systems. One, for those who can afford those kinds of resources, really big guys, and then those who can't. And there's winners and losers to that. And the winners are multinational pharmaceutical companies and tech companies. The losers are small businesses and retailers and taxpayers who can't afford those kinds of resources. And so that's not really a very good way to organize our tax system. Anyway, so there's lots of ways we can go about trying to solve that problem. The legislature in 2013, you'll recall, took one very, very good step. Our testimony itemizes what that is. For those of you who were around at that point, it was unanimous, so thank you for passing that. That was a good first step towards cracking down on offshore tax havens. Another step that you can take is to increase transparency. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. The bill has a number of ways which you can go about that. The principle would be that it would require corporations at some level to disclose their tax liability and then itemize at some level what are the credits and deductions that got them to that point. And the main reason why you'd want to do that is just to have some facts in front of you when you make decisions regarding corporate taxation. To just know that would be valuable, and then to know how the laws that you and your predecessors have established and your colleagues in Congress have established, how they interact with each other to what the outcome is valuable, so that you can then make just more of an informed decision about what the corporate tax rate ought to be. And we would maintain that there's a wide variety of opinion in this building about what the level of corporate taxes ought to be. And regardless of where you come from on that, you'd probably want to know just what actually are people paying, because we do know that many don't pay what the legal statutory rate is, and so just knowing that allows us to make a better choice. So one argument against doing this kind of thing is that it could be anti-competitive, meaning it could require companies to disclose proprietary information. I think we would just say, please keep in mind that not all information is proprietary, not all information is the same, and one question that you could ask is just going, where is the line, and what are the things that we can do that are well before the line, and then we could debate and quibble about all the other things. And so the portions of the bill that we support that, again, are itemized in the written testimony are things that, in our estimation, are well before the line, and where the public's interest and your interest in being able to make good decisions would outweigh whatever, you know, argument could be made about that being proprietary. And so we would urge you to, at least as a starting point, consider adopting those, and then you could obviously move forward in future years in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Chuck Shekatoff, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, here in support of House Bill 2077. You know that in the early 80s, Citizens for Tax Justice at the national level did a report showing the variation in taxes paid and sometimes not paid by large corporations. And it's been credited with leading to the 1986 Tax Reform Act that Bob Packwood shepherded through Congress that closed a lot of corporate loopholes and changed our corporate tax system. I always get confused about, can't remember which was which, but in that report, Westinghouse and GE, which to members of Congress and most Americans, I think, seem like pretty similar companies. They make engines, they make appliances, they're electronics companies. One was paying a lot in taxes and one was paying very little. And that's one of the, that's just one example of why Congress did some stuff to change and make our tax system more fair back in 86. The information is available, lots of detailed information is available for those publicly traded companies with their SEC filings. And it's a, you know, concern about proprietary, I think, is rather bogus, given that it's sort of yesterday's news, tomorrow's when you're getting it. And it's much more detailed at the SEC level than this bill would require at the state level. I do have a few suggestions for changes in the bill. The most key one is, I think, the on line 13 on page 1, it should be 250. I think that may be a Scribner's error, or more full-time equivalents of the non-publicly traded companies.
Instead of 25.
Instead of 25,
thank
right.
You.
Daniel mentioned the data on companies using credits to get to zero. We've actually just received, and we're going to be publishing a short paper shortly, more detailed data on who those 393 companies are that got to pay absolutely nothing because of being able to use credits against the minimum tax. At least 49 of them have Oregon income of over $1 million. At least 49 have income of over $1 million. And over half of them have sales of over $1 million in Oregon. There's questions, people have raised questions about whether this is bad for the business climate in Oregon. You know, Oregon's business Oregon office quotes the same study that we all quote and cite, and that your legislative revenue office has said is probably the best survey of tax burdens on business, which is the Council on State Taxation report that comes out every year. And we've always been fairly low, really low. The most recent one, we were the lowest in business taxes on state and state and local taxes on businesses, not on corporations per se. And they cite that we have low taxes, but they also note on their webpage that's probably not the decision that gets people to come here. It's our workforce, it's our quality of life, it's our public structures that support the business environment. So I don't believe taxes are part of the business climate, but I don't think this would harm that. I mean, I think when Oregon's recruiting a business to come here, they'd be able to show, you're going to pay low taxes. Look at a similar manufacturer. Look what they're paying. They're paying low taxes. You'd also see which companies are paying their fair share in taxes. So I just don't see it as an issue of hurting the business climate. Concerns in the past when this bill has come up is, oh, it'll be confusing for people, and people will misunderstand the information. Well, there's a provision in the bill that allows businesses, when they file the form, the Secretary of State has to give them space to explain the information on their form to help allay those concerns. It's not going to hurt or even touch small businesses. I don't think a small business, if you raise it to 250 employees or more than $10 million, I think that exempts small businesses. businesses. $10 million is over $800,000 a month or close to $200,000 in Oregon sales each week. It's not the coffee shop or shoe store that I go to. So I just think it doesn't affect small businesses, but it does need to impact large non-publicly traded businesses. We have some very large ones in the state. The largest wood products manufacturer in the country, if not the world, Geldwin, is not publicly traded and is located here in Oregon, or part of them is located here in Oregon. So we need to have the information. You know, when they were a big taxpayer, Intel Corporation used to publicize how much they paid in taxes. If you go back to the Oregonian in the late 90s, you'll see that they paid $50 million or more in taxes each year, and they published studies boasting about their corporate income taxes. They were successful at changing the corporate income tax code, so now they're probably paying our minimum tax or less. And so you don't see that in the studies, the boilerplate studies that Echo Northwest produces for them. But they would boast about their taxes. It's not a bad thing to know the taxes that are being paid. And it'll help you make the right decisions. You know, if you're talking with the governor said, I want my head of the Department of Revenue in on a meeting with legislative leaders to negotiate a corporate tax bill, and one business is sitting there saying, well, we're already paying too much, and the Department of Revenue knows they're not paying anything, I think you ought to know that too. And I think the public ought to know that, whether or not, and have a fair negotiations about it. And if you see inconsistencies, so for instance, I live here in the Valley and shop at Roth's independent grocer. If independent grocers like Roth's are paying more in taxes than Albertson Safeway, which is now one entity, we should know that and try to figure out how does a large company like Albertson Safeway get away with paying less in taxes than the Roth's chain. And only through disclosure can you learn that. So I think it's good for business and it's good for Oregon and it's good for better policy on taxes. And I urge you to support the bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt, please.
I'm not a lawyer, just a geologist. So I just have a question. If Oregon enticed corporate investment through tax credits, come to our state, build something, are those tax credits in that agreement considered a contract? Because it's my understanding under constitutional law that we don't have the ability to unilaterally change a contract unless we refer it to the people or the legislature overturn the Constitution. And I was just wondering, what's your opinion of the agreement that the state of Oregon has made?
That's really a legislative council question.
Okay.
I think Chris has a little insight on it that he might share.
It really is a legislative council question, and there's some nuances to it.
What he said a minute ago was that it's an open question.
Yeah, there's an open question, and it depends. You get into issues of whether or not a tax credit has been sold or transferred, and so you have an entity that maybe earns the credit and then somebody else who's claiming the credit. So there's some complexities like that.
So how do we, as a legislative body, act on a law when we don't have the answer to that question?
Well, during the time I've been on the committee, we've made a lot of tax changes. We've put sunsets on credits. We've done a whole bunch of things that we even passed one bill that had a retroactive effect by the time it was finally approved by the people. Actually, two bills, Measure 66 and 67, that went back a year before the time of the election. I don't think anybody challenged it legally on the grounds that we couldn't do it. I think we can do it. My understanding, at least, is that the issues that come up in this area have to do with when somebody has signed a contract with a third party. The one that Chris referred to is when I have a tax credit that I can't use and I sell it to somebody else and they pay me for it. That one we may be stuck with paying regardless unless we've got some other rules already in place under the contract provision you're thinking about. But otherwise, I would argue, subject, of course, to legislative council saying otherwise, that we can make lots of changes in tax law, even retroactively, as a legislature, if that seems to be good public policy to us. Did you have a different question that the panel might actually talk to? Chuck, do you want to talk on that
one? Mr. Chairman, yeah. Representative Whitsitt, I guess I'm not really sure how I understand the question, I think. I don't know the answer. And I'm no longer a lawyer, so I get to plead that as well. But, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the bill because the bill doesn't change any tax law. The bill is a disclosure bill. Bill doesn't change any tax law. Will tell you, I'll be fully honest with you, I call this the climate change that we want bill. The climate change to create the climate when we get the information to address the problems in our tax code. But it does not change any tax credit or anything. It just has disclosure of what companies are getting. It has a disclosure of the carry forwards. Right now, if you ask the Department of Revenue, how many carry forwards are on the books of Oregon corporations? They don't know. They don't have a schedule on a corporate tax return where they have to list all the carry forwards they're saving for future years. This would help us get closer to that because the companies that have to file this will have to give a schedule of carry forwards.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. I'm going to move forward.
A short one?
Representative Smith-Warner.
Also, partially, I apologize, Chair, because I have another obligation in a few minutes. I just wanted to go in on that concept that what I find interesting about this is indeed we do want, as legislators, I think there is a huge public policy implication in our being able to assess the efficacy of our laws, in this case, in our tax laws, when we can indeed see, I've spoken with people and organizations who say, well, this will help this certain kind of business, you know, increase or expand or whatever, and it'll be really targeted to small and medium family-owned businesses or whatever it is. And I think we do have a very difficult time in assessing how well our tax policy is working when we cannot see, okay, we're going to pass this and then see indeed are the kind of companies we hoped to incent taking advantage of that, or are they not? Is it having unintended consequences? And I just think that the policy implications of indeed increased transparency for us, of being able to see the impact of what our tax policy is doing, I think that's a really significant advantage to this or some kind of transparency bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for this panel. I have a lot of people to testify. We have about 18 minutes. I'm going to call panels and ask them to talk only about things that haven't already been talked about. I'm going to call a panel of those who've indicated that they're opposed to the measure first, because we've heard from a panel that was in favor. And then I'm going to ask who in the group is very unlikely to be able to come back another time because of other commitments. Brad Morrison, Tracy Hensley, Kay Bridges, please. Thank you. I apologize for trying to rush you along, but I'm trying to get as many people in as I can today.
That's quite all right.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the board, my name is Brad Morrison, and I'm here to oppose HB 2077. I've had little time to really fully review this bill, but a few things that I did notice jumped out at me that gave me some concern. One of them is I'm concerned for the potential violation of privacy as protected by law for some individuals listed in this bill. And I'd like some clarification somewhere down the line on the term affiliates as used in Section 2, Subsection B. It seems a rather broad term. The requirements in this bill in general strike me as a cumbersome burden to impose on an already beleaguered business environment. The extra cost that may be incurred to comply with the proposed requirements seems to me that they'd have enough impact to possibly close the doors of many smaller businesses, which tend to cater to larger businesses, something that our volatile economy could ill afford. A number of the requirements enumerated under Section 3, particularly Subsection J, tax credits claimed each credit individually enumerated. That strikes me as an independent business owner myself. This could basically amount to kind of like an annual audit almost. This bill strikes me as extremely intrusive and so complex and ambiguous in nature as to amount to a penal mechanism designed to generate revenue via fees, fines, and penalties, and I urge a no vote on this thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I had some of the same concerns as Mr. Morrison.
And would you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, Tracy Hensley.
Thank you, Tracy.
And but more specific, I have more questions than answers on this myself. But I think my biggest concern I come with today is that the testimony supporting this bill seems to be directed towards larger corporations that would employ thousands of people, Nike, Apple, Microsoft, these types of companies. And in my hometown, 18 of our 20 biggest employees or employers employ more than 25 folks. So this could potentially affect them. And my concern.
Do they employ more than 250?
No, it says 25.
It does here in this bill. You're right.
Yes.
But one of the comments we got from one of the proponents of the bill was that he thought it was a Scrivener's error and it should have been 250.
Well, I would like that clarified because this was kind of alarming when I saw that.
Right.
And it was 18 of our 20 biggest employers are 25 or more people.
Right.
And there's only one major retailer, Fred Meyer, in that bunch, where most of them are produced and distributed locally made products. And these are, one family grocer and then manufacturers. And so this would have a potential of having them either cut some jobs to get under that threshold or maybe even leave the state. And I would like us to do something more to create a more business-friendly environment rather than scaring them away. And if there's concerning loopholes that we're trying to address, maybe we should address those rather than creating an entire new law that would affect so many more people.
Thank you very
much. I urge a no vote.
Appreciate that. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Kay Bridges, and I am opposed to what I see in this bill. I had a business that started in the 80s. I heard reference to the 80s earlier and all of the business reforms that happened about that time, and I felt like a victim of those supposed reforms, mostly because my business grew as a single-owner floral business. We had other things as well, to a 300,000, almost a 300,000 gross business in the 80s, unheard of. Mm-hmm. So the state of Oregon said one of my time payments, because I was growing by 80%. If you have any idea what 80% can do to a business, it can break a business pretty darn fast. You are using yesterday's money to buy tomorrow's increased product.
Yeah.
And you have no money today, and you live on nothing as an owner.
Yep.
How do you know these businesses aren't suffering through the same thing? It makes me angry. I just tweeted and said, please, Lord, help me not scream the next time I hear, make them pay their fair share. When I realize what these businesses go through, guess who the other businesses were right next door to me at that time? Nike, Mentor Graphics, Adidas, Avia, Enterprise. They started in a downtime, and they learned how to suffer through those downtimes. And they learned how to make a profit. And how do you get a profit, by the way, that I saw mentioned earlier in the work session, if you don't have jobs where the people get to earn money to pay the taxes? So if there aren't the jobs and they can't pay taxes, then maybe you have a valid point. But if they have more jobs and they pay more taxes, maybe the businesses don't have any money like I didn't have any money in 1980s when my business was growing by 80%. And because my payment arrived in Salem one day late, they did a full audit on me. 5.5 days in my flower shop while I'm at the Oregon tent down at the Rose Festival, pulling more information every single day. I mailed it on Monday. It was due on Friday, and they say it didn't arrive until the next Monday. Baloney. I even came down here and asked for documentation from that audit after my dad died and my husband's hospital bouts. And they said, oh, it's too late. We don't have those records now. Well, everybody tells me maybe they owed me money. So how do we know the large corporations don't suffer through the same things I did as a 300,000 gross business? And why, if it's 25, hopefully it's a Scrivener's error, 25 people full-time at Valentine's delivering over 400 deliveries in 2 days. And the rest of the time, I had 3 full-time people. So what criteria does this bill give us? I appreciate Chair Barnhart and committee. I did not address you at the beginning of this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for yours. We appreciate it very much. And thank you for coming and sitting through the rest of the meeting today. I want to ask now, I have 2+ pages of people who want to talk. We have 10 more minutes today. If people want to come back, we'll hold another hearing at a time that I can't tell you right now because I don't know. Of those who signed up, is there anybody here who cannot come back later? Please, you're next. Who else? Yes. Yes, sir. Mr. Calhoun, come forward, please. Who else? All right, gentlemen, please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Peterson, Vice Chair Benz, and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. I'm a resident of Portland. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Center for Christian Voices. OCCV is a faith-based nonprofit seeking to activate Christians on issues of economic and social justice. We believe Scripture is clear that God's intended role for government is to assure that poor and marginalized people are cared for and that all individuals have the opportunity to flourish. We believe a budget is a moral document and that our state budget reflects who and what is important and who and what is not. We support HB 2940 and HB 277 so that the legislature will have the tools to properly weigh tax incentives for large corporations against the needs for education, broad-based infrastructure investments, and care for the indigent or disadvantaged in our society. Typically, tax breaks are provided with good intentions at the time that are granted to incentivize specific economic activity. Sometimes those tax breaks continue long after the time that they can be justified, and sometimes the promises made at the time are simply not met. Sometimes corporations find ways to avoid paying any taxes in ways not intended by this legislature. Tax expenditures need to be fully weighed by the legislature against other pressing needs. Oregon is above the national average in child hunger, and nearly half the people assisted by food stamps are 18 or younger. Right now, Oregon cannot fund a full school year and reasonable class sizes for our students. Rising college tuition is preventing some of our citizens from attending university and reaching their full potential. Law enforcement in some parts of the state is practically non-existent. Families with children too often live in cars or other unsafe conditions because they can't afford an apartment. HB 2940 and HB 2077 will not solve our budgetary problems. However, they are a necessary step to ensure that the legislature and the public understand what the trade-offs are. During a period of great and growing income and wealth disparity, we need to bring light to the debate over who is benefiting from advantageous tax breaks and who is being hurt. As an Oregonian member of the faith community who cares about protecting vulnerable kids, families, and seniors, I encourage you to support these bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, and other members. My name is David Roth. I'm a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. I had to go plug the meter, so I wasn't here to hear what the previous proponents were saying, so I might be a bit redundant, but I will try to be brief. If a strong version of this bill were passed in this session, the work of this committee would be so much easier and more fruitful. So would the work of TFO, of the press, and all the citizens who wish to understand and influence our tax structure. As our Oregon has pointed out, businesses are already routinely disclosing this kind of information from their federal income tax. We still have battles over the interpretation and enforcement of our public records laws, but those laws have been in place for decades. Corporations are public entities, too. They would not exist except for the articles of incorporation required by the laws of Oregon. This bill simply affirms the obvious that it is in the interest of the public to require public disclosure from any public entity, including corporations. The health industry is a good example of the trend towards public disclosure of information that businesses would prefer to keep private. I'm referring to the requirements that hospitals and physicians disclose their success rates in surgery, including, nowadays, readmittance rates. Under Obamacare, fortunately, insurance companies and hospitals are now required to publicize their fee structures so that Americans can finally be informed consumers. I see this as a perfectly suitable precedent that is in the healthcare field for what is being proposed here concerning corporate taxation, that it is in the interest of the public to learn more about the activities, in particular tax activities, in this state. Let me summarize by saying this. These health industry reforms took decades. Oregon's political leaders and healthcare leaders led the way. We have a lot to be proud of in that regard. Let's apply the same foresight and grit to public disclosure of corporate taxes. It's the future.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. I'm going to try to call the next panel and see if we can get you in. Russ, with a last name beginning with a D, and I can't. Oh, thank you. Mr. Rosenthal, Josie, is it Kearney?
We can just speak for one.
Yeah.
Actually, you want to do that?
Yeah, the bill.
I'm sorry. Am I on the other side
for all of us, or should I?
No. I'm going to be very brief in my comments.
But you signed up on 2077,
yes.
And that's the bill that we're talking about.
Right.
Today.
We're going to come back when the other bill is up again.
Thank you.
Because that's really our major focus. But we felt that, my name's Russ Dondero. I live in Forest Grove, and I'm a member of three different coalitions. The one involved with the Tax Fairness Oregon, WCCAN, and Interfaith Community on Homelessness. And so the three of us have been working together with other people to craft a bill that would get at these issues of transparency. So we like what House Bill 277 does because it begins to unwind the issue of transparency in a way that is understandable to everyone. And I think that's an important policy objective, so that when policy on taxation is discussed in this body, as well as elsewhere, we know what we're talking about. Data is necessary to make quality decisions. The other comment I want to make is that many of the corporations that have been implied in this conversation happen to be recipients of a variety of Oregon programs, including the Strategic Investment Program and many other tax credits and grants programs, so that, in effect, we as taxpayers have become part of the stakeholder group that helps corporations like Intel, Nike, et cetera, manage a complex global economy successfully. So as de facto stakeholders, I think we have a right to know what our money is going for and producing. So the transparency issue is above and beyond everything else that I've heard, particularly the first set of panels.
Thank you.
That's why I support this bill, and I think we do.
Thank you.
My name is Garrett Rosenthal. I live in Tualatin. I'm representing right now Tax Recovery on Investment Coalition, and our primary concerns on a number of bills, and there's a number of bills dealing with transparency and with tax issues before the legislature this session, have to do with transparency, accountability, and particularly the wisdom of how Oregon invests our money, which is our tax money that goes into them. And that includes not only how money is spent on expenditures, but also how money is gotten and how it's gotten fairly from those that owe money. So we have reviewed this as part of our review of other measures, and we support it because it is a step in the right direction in that regard. So that's all I need to say on this.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
I can forego my commentary, but I just feel that the disclosure of corporate taxes is a huge huge factor.
State your name for the record.
Oh, excuse
please.
Me. Josephine Kerner, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. a huge portion of, we have property taxes going back, corporate taxes forgiveness that amounts to a great deal of money, and we need to know how much that is and see that together with a lot of other information. So we'll talk to that in another bill, another time.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming today, and I appreciate it. Colleagues, we are going to, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2077. We are going to repost this bill for additional public hearing and House Bill 2940, which we didn't get to today. We're going to set over till tomorrow the work session on House Bill 2489. Paul, have I got all the announcements I need to give? Thank you very much. Thank you, colleagues, and thank you for coming, and I apologize we didn't get to you all today. With that, the committee is adjourned.